urge of telling his father, from whom they had kept their worries secret, no father wants a damaged child, he burst into sound, and became, in that respect at any rate, utterly normal. "It's as if," Amina whispered to Mary, "he's decided to put our minds at rest." There was one more serious problem. Amina and Mary took a few days to notice it, busy with the mighty complex processes of turning themselves into a two-headed mother, their vision clouded by a fog of stenchy underwear. They failed to notice the immobility of my eyelids. Amina, remembering how, during a pregnancy, the weight of her unborn child had held time as still as a dead green pond, began to wonder whether the reverse might not be taking place now, whether the baby had some magical power over all the time in his immediate vicinity, and was speeding it up so that mother and Aya never had enough time to do everything that needed doing, so that the baby could grow at an apparently fantastic rate. Lost in such chronological daydreams, she didn't notice my problem. Only when she shrugged the idea off and told herself I was just a good strapping boy with a big appetite, an early developer, did the veils of maternal love part sufficiently for her and Mary to yelp in unison, "Look, bapre bap, look, madam, see, Mary, the little chap never blinks." The eyes were too blue, Kashmiri blue, changeling blue, blue with the weight of unspilled tears, too blue to blink. When I was fed, my eyes did not flutter. When virginal Mary set me across her shoulder crying, "Oof, so heavy, sweet Jesus," I burped without nictating. When Amit Sanai limped splint-toed to my crib, I yielded to jutting lips with keen and batless gaze. "Maybe a mistake, madam," Mary suggested. "Maybe the little sub is copying us, blinking when we blink." And Amina, "We'll blink in turn and watch." Their eyelids opening and closing alternately, they observed my icy blueness. But there was not the slightest tremor, until Amina took matters into her own hands and reached into the cradle to stroke my eyelids downwards. They closed. My breathing altered instantly to the contented rhythms of sleep. After that, for several months, mother and I took it in turns to open and close my lids. "He'll learn, madam," Mary comforted Amina. "He is a good, obedient child, and he will get the hang of it for sure." I learned the first lesson of my life. Nobody can face the world with his eyes open all the time. Now, looking back through baby eyes, I can see it all perfectly. It's amazing how much you can remember when you try. What I can see, the city, basking like a bloodsucker lizard in the summer heat, our Bombay. It looks like a hand, but it's really a mouth, always open, always hungry, swallowing food and talent from everywhere else in India. A glamorous leech producing nothing except films, bush shirts, fish. In the aftermath of partition, I see Vishwanath, the postboy, bicycling towards our two-story hillock, vellum envelope in his saddlebag, riding his aged Arjuna India bike past a rotting bus. Abandoned, although it isn't the monsoon season, because its driver suddenly decided to leave for Pakistan, switched off the engine and departed, leaving a full busload of stranded passengers hanging off the windows, clinging to the roof rack, bulging through the doorway. I can hear their oaths, "Son of a pig, brother of a jackass," but they will cling to their hard-worn places for 2 hours before they leave the bus to its fate. And... here is India's first swimmer of the English Channel, Mr. Pushpa Roy, arriving at the gates of the Breach Candy Pools, saffron bathing cap on his head, green trunks wrapped in flag-hued towel. This Pushpa has declared war on the whites-only policy of the baths. He holds a cake of Mysore sandalwood soap, draws himself up, marches through the gate, whereupon hired Pathans seize him, Indians save Europeans from an Indian mutiny, as usual, and out he goes, struggling valiantly, frog-marched into Warden Road and flung into the dust. Channel swimmer dives into the street, narrowly missing camels, taxis, bicycles. Vishwanath swerves to avoid his cake of soap, but he is not deterred. picks himself up, dusts himself down, and promises to be back tomorrow. Throughout my childhood, years, the days were punctuated by the sight of Pushpa the swimmer, in saffron cap and flag-tinted towel, diving unwillingly into Warden Road. And in the end, his indomitable campaign won a victory, because today the pools permit certain Indians, the better sort, to step into their map-shaped waters. But Pushpa does not belong to the better sort. Old now and forgotten, he watches the pools from afar. And now more and more of the multitudes are flooding into me, such as Bano Devi, the famous lady wrestler of those days, who would only wrestle men and threaten to marry anyone who beat her, as a result of which vow she never lost a bout. And closer to home now, the sadhu under our garden tap, whose name was Purushottam, and whom we, Sunny, Eye Slice, Hairoa, Cyrus and I, would always call Puru the Guru. Believing me to be the Mubarak, the Blessed One, he devoted his life to keeping an eye on me and filled his days teaching my father palmistry and witching away my mother's verrucas. And then there is the rivalry of the old bearer Musa and the new ayah Mary, which will grow until it explodes. In short, at the end of 1947, life in Bombay was as teeming, as manifold, as multitudinously shapeless as ever. Except that I had arrived. I was already beginning to take my place at the centre of the universe, and by the time I had finished, I would give meaning to it all. You don't believe me? Listen. At my cradle side, Mary Pereira is singing a little song. Anything you want to be, you can be. You can be just what all you want. By the time of my circumcision by a barber with a cleft palate from the Royal Barber House on Gowalia Tank Road, I was just over 2 months old. I was already much in demand at Methil's estate. Incidentally, on the subject of the circumcision, I still swear that I can remember the grinning barber who held me by the foreskin while my member waggled frantically like a slithering snake, and the razor descending, and the pain. But I am told that, at the time, I didn't even blink. Yes, I was a popular little fellow. My two mothers, Amina and Mary, couldn't get enough of me. In all practical matters, they were the most intimate of allies. After my circumcision, they bathed me together and giggled together as my mutilated organ waggled angrily in the bathwater. "We better watch this boy, madam," Mary said naughtily. "His thing has a life of its own." And Amina, "Mary, you're terrible, really." But then, amid sobs of helpless laughter, "Just see, madam, his poor little susu." Because it was wiggling again, thrashing about like a chicken with a slitted gullet. Together they cared for me beautifully. But in the matter of emotion, they were deadly rivals. Once, when they took me for a pram ride through the hanging gardens on Malabar Hill, Amina overheard Mary telling the other eyes, "Look, here's my own big son," and felt oddly threatened. Baby Salim became, after that, the battleground of their loves. They strove to outdo one another in demonstrations of affection, while he, blinking by now, gurgling aloud, fed on their emotions, using it to accelerate his growth, expanding and swallowing infinite hugs, kisses, chucks under the chin, charging towards the moment when he would acquire the essential characteristic of human beings. Every day, and only in those rare moments when I was left alone with the fisherman's pointing finger, I tried to heave myself erect in my cot. And while I made unavailing efforts to get to my feet, Amina too was in the grip of a useless resolve. She was trying to expel from her mind the dream of her unnameable husband, which had replaced the dream of flypaper on the night after I was born, a dream of such overwhelming reality that it stayed with her throughout her waking hours. In it, Nadir Khan came to her bed and impregnated her. Such was the mischievous perversity of the dream that it confused Amina about the parentage of her child and provided me, the child of midnight, with a fourth father to set beside Winky and Methil and Ahmed Sanai. Agitated but helpless in the clutches of the dream, my mother Amina began at that time to form the fog of guilt which would, in later years, surround her head like a dark black wreath. I never heard Wee Willie Winkie in his prime. After his blind-eyed bereavement, his sight gradually returned, but something harsh and bitter crept into his voice. He told us it was asthma and continued to arrive at Methil's estate once a week to sing songs which were, like himself, relics of the Methil era. "Good night, ladies," he sang, and keeping up to date added, "The clouds will soon roll by," to his repertoire, and, a little later, "How much is that doggy in the window?" Placing a sizable infant with menacingly knocking knees on a small mat beside him in the circus ring, he sang songs filled with nostalgia, and nobody had the heart to turn him away. Winky and the Fisherman's Finger were two of the few survivals of the days of William Methil, because after the Englishman's disappearance, his successors emptied his palaces of their abandoned contents. Leela Sabarmati preserved a pianola. Amit Sanai kept his whiskey cabinet. Old Man Ibrahim came to terms with ceiling fans. But the goldfish died, some from starvation, others as a result of being so colossally overfed that they exploded in little clouds of scales and undigested fish food. The dogs ran wild and eventually ceased to roam the estate, and the fading clothes in the old Elmiras were distributed amongst the sweeperwomen and other servants on the estate, so that for years afterwards the heirs of William Methil were cared for by men and women wearing the increasingly ragged shirts and cotton print dresses of their erstwhile masters. But Winky and the picture on my wall survived. Singer and fisherman became institutions of our lives, like the cocktail hour, which was already a habit too powerful to be broken. "Each little tear and sorrow," Winky sang, "only brings you closer to me." And his voice grew worse and worse until it sounded like a sitar whose resonating drum, made out of lacquered pumpkin, had been eaten away by mice. "It's asthma," he insisted stubbornly. Before he died, he lost his voice completely. Doctors revised his diagnosis to throat cancer. But they were wrong too, because Winky died of no disease, but of the bitterness of losing a wife whose infidelity he never suspected. His son, named Shiva, after the god of procreation and destruction, sat at his feet in those early days, silently bearing the burden of being the cause, or so he thought, of his father's slow decline. And gradually, down the years, we watched his eyes filling with an anger which could not be spoken. We watched his fists close around pebbles and hurl them, ineffectually at first, more dangerously as he grew, into the surrounding emptiness. When Leela Sabarmati's elder son was 8, he took it upon himself to tease young Shiva about his surliness, his unstarched shorts, his knobbly knees, whereupon the boy, whom Mary's crime had doomed to poverty and accordions, hurled a sharp flat stone with a cutting edge like a razor and blinded his tormentor in the right eye. After Eye Slice's accident, Wee Willie Winky came to Methil's estate alone, leaving his son to enter the dark labyrinths from which only a war would save him. Why Methil's estate continued to tolerate Wee Willie Winky despite the decay of his voice and the violence of his son? He had, once, given them an important clue about their lives. "The first bath," he had said, "will make you real." As a direct result of Winky's clue, I was, in my early days, highly in demand. Amina and Mary vied for my attention, but in every house on the estate there were people who wanted to know me, and eventually Amina, allowing her pride in my popularity to overcome her reluctance to let me out of her sight, agreed to lend me on a kind of rota basis to the various families on the hill. Pushed by Mary Pereira in a sky-blue pram, I began a triumphal progress around the red-tile palaces, gracing each in turn with my presence and making them seem real to their owners. And so, looking back now through the eyes of baby Salim, I can reveal most of the secrets of my neighbourhood, because the grown-ups lived their lives in my presence without fear of being observed, not knowing that years later someone would look back through baby eyes and decide to let the cats out of their bags. So here is old man Ibrahim, dying with worry because back in Africa, governments are nationalizing his sisal plantations. Here is his elder son, Isahak, fretting over his hotel business, which is running into debt, so that he is obliged to borrow money from local gangsters. Here are Isahak's eyes, coveting his brother's wife. Though why Nussi the duck should have aroused sexual interest in anyone is a mystery to me. And here is Nussi's husband, Ishmael the lawyer, who has learned an important lesson from his son's forceps birth. Nothing comes out right in life, he tells his duck of a wife, unless it's forced out. Applying this philosophy to his legal career, he embarks on a career of bribing judges and fixing juries. All children have the power to change their parents, and Sonny turned his father into a highly successful crook. And, moving across to Versailles Villa, here is Mrs. Dubosch, with her shrine to the god Ganesh, stuck in the corner of an apartment of such supernatural untidiness that, in our house, the word Dubosch became a verb meaning to make a mess.
"Oh, Selim, you've Dubosched your room again, you black man!" Mary would cry.
And now the cause of the mess, leaning over the hood of my pram to chuck me under the chin. Adi Dubosch, the physicist, genius of atoms and litter. His wife, who is already carrying Cyrus the Great within her, hangs back, growing her child with something fanatical gleaming in the inner corners of her eyes, biding its time. It would not emerge until Mr. Dubosch, whose daily life was spent working with the most dangerous substances in the world, dies by choking on an orange from which his wife forgot to remove the pips. I was never invited into the flat of Dr. Nalika, the child-hating gynecologist, but in the homes of Leela Sabarmati and Homi Katrak, I became a voyeur, a tiny party to Leela's 1001 infidelities, and eventually a witness to the beginnings of a liaison between the naval officer's wife and the film magnate and racehorse owner, which, all in good time, would serve me well when I planned a certain act of revenge. Even a baby is faced with the problem of defining itself, and I'm bound to say that my early popularity had its problematic aspects, because I was bombarded with a confusing multiplicity of views on the subject, being a blessed one to a guru under a tap, a voyeur to Leela Sabarmati, in the eyes of Nussi the duck, I was a rival, and a more successful rival to her own Sonny, although, to her credit, she never showed her resentment and asked to borrow me, just like everyone else. To my two-headed mother, I was all kinds of babyish things. They called me Junu Munu and Puch Puch and Little Piece of the Moon. But what, after all, can a baby do except swallow all of it and hope to make sense of it later? Patiently, dry-eyed, I imbibed Nehru Letter and Winky's Prophecy, but the deepest impression of all was made on the day when Homi Katrak's idiot daughter sent her thoughts across the circus ring and into my infant head. Toxie Katrak, of the outsize head and dribbling mouth. Toxie, who stood at a barred top-floor window, stark naked, masturbating with motions of consummate self-disgust, who spat hard and often through her bars and sometimes hit us on the head. She was 21 years old, a gibbering half-wit, the product of years of inbreeding. But inside my head she was beautiful, because she had not lost the gifts with which every baby is born and which life proceeds to erode. I can't remember anything Toxie said when she sent her thoughts to whisper to me. Probably nothing except gurgles and spittings. But she gave a door in my mind, a little nudge, so that when an accident took place in a washing chest, it was probably Toxie who made it possible. That's enough for the moment about the first days of baby Salim. Already my very presence is having an effect on history. Already baby Salim is working changes on the people around him. And in the case of my father, I am convinced that it was I who pushed him into the excesses which led, perhaps inevitably, to the terrifying time of the freeze. Amit Sanai never forgave his son for breaking his toe. Even after the splint was removed, a tiny limp remained. My father leaned over my crib and said, "So, my son, you're starting as you mean to go on. Already you've started bashing your poor old father. In my opinion, this was only half a joke, because with my birth, everything changed for Amit Sanai. His position in the household was undermined by my coming. Suddenly, Amina's assiduity had acquired different goals. She never wheedled money out of him anymore, and the napkin in his lap at the breakfast table felt sad pangs of nostalgia for the old days. Now it was, "Your son needs so-and-so," or, "Janum, you must give money for such-and-such." Bad show, Amit Sanai thought. My father was a self-important man. And so it was my doing that Amit Sanai fell, in those days after my birth, into the twin fantasies which were to be his undoing, into the unreal worlds of the jinns and of the land beneath the sea. A memory of my father in a cool season evening, sitting on my bed. I was 7 years old, and telling me, in a slightly thickened voice, the story of the fisherman who found the gin in a bottle washed up on the beach. "Never believe in a jinn's promises, my son. Let them out of the bottle and they'll eat you up." And I, timidly, because I could smell danger on my father's breath, "But Abba, can a jinn really live inside a bottle?" Whereupon my father, in a mercurial change of mood, roared with laughter and left the room, returning with a dark green bottle with a white label. "Look," he said sonorously, "do you want to see the jinn in here?"
"No,"
I squealed in fright, "but..."
"Yes,"
yelled my sister, the brass monkey, from the neighbouring bed. And cowering together in excited terror, we watched him unscrew the cap and dramatically cover the bottleneck with the palm of his hand. And now, in the other hand, a cigarette lighter materialised.
"So perish all evil jinns," my father cried, and removing his palm, applied the flame to the neck of the bottle.
Awestruck, the monkey and I watched an eerie flame, blue, green, yellow, move in a slow circle down the interior walls of the bottle until, reaching the bottom, it flared briefly and died. The next day, I provoked gales of laughter when I told Sunny, Eye Slice and Hair Oil, "My father fights with jinns. He beats them. It's true." And it was true. Amit Sanai, deprived of wheedles and attention, began, soon after my birth, a lifelong struggle with gin bottles. But I was mistaken about one thing. He didn't win. Cocktail cabinets had whetted his appetite, but it was my arrival that drove him to it. In those days, Bombay had been declared a dry state. The only way to get a drink was to get yourself certified as an alcoholic. And so a new breed of doctors sprang up, gin doctors, one of whom, Dr. Sharabi, was introduced to my father by Homi Catrack next door. After that, on the first of every month, my father and Mr. Catrack and many of the city's most respectable men queued up outside Dr. Sharabi's mottled glass surgery door, went in, and emerged with the little pink chitties of alcoholism. But the permitted ration was too small for my father's needs. And so he began to send his servants along too, and gardeners, bearers, drivers. We had a motor car now, a 1946 Rover with running boards, just like William Methil's. Even old Musa and Mary Pereira brought my father back more and more pink chitties, which he took to VJ stores opposite the circumcising barbershop in Galwalia Tank Road and exchanged for the brown paper bags of alcoholism, inside which were the chinking green bottles full of gin, and whiskey too. Amit Sanai blurred the edges of himself by drinking the green bottles and red labels of his servants. The poor, having little else to peddle, sold their identities on little pieces of pink paper, and my father turned them into liquid and drank them down. At 6 o'clock every evening, Amit Sanai entered the world of the jinns, and every morning, his eyes red, his head throbbing with the fatigue of his night-long battle, he came unshaven to the breakfast table. And with the passage of the years, the good mood of the time before he shaved was replaced by the irritable exhaustion of his war with the bottle spirits. After breakfast, he went downstairs. He had set aside 2 rooms on the ground floor for his office, because his sense of direction was as bad as ever, and he didn't relish the notion of getting lost in Bombay on the way to work. Even he could find his way down a flight of stairs. Blurred at the edges, my father did his property deals, and his growing anger at my mother's preoccupation with a child found a new outlet behind his office door. Ahmed Sanai began to flirt with his secretaries. After nights in which his quarrel with bottles would sometimes erupt in harsh language, "What a wife I found! I should have bought myself a son and hired a nurse! What difference?" And then tears, and Amina, "Oh, Janum, don't torture me," which in turn provoked, "Torture my foot! You think it's torture for a man to ask his wife for attention? God save me from stupid women!" My father limped downstairs to make googly eyes at Colaba girls, and after a while Amina began to notice how his secretaries never lasted long, how they left suddenly, flouncing down our drive, without any notice. And you must judge whether she chose to be blind or whether she took it as a punishment. But she did nothing about it, continuing to devote her time to me. Her only act of recognition was to give the girls a collective name. "Those Anglos," she said to Mary, revealing a touch of snobbery, "with their funny names, Fernanda and Alonso and all, and surnames, my God, Sulaka and Colaco, and I don't know what. What should I care about them, cheap-type females? I call them his Coca-Cola girls. That's what they all sound like." While Ahmed pinched bottoms, Amina became long-suffering. But he might have been glad if she had appeared to care. Mary Pereira said, "They aren't so funny names, madam. Beg your pardon, but they are good Christian words." And Amina remembered Ahmed's cousin Zora making fun of dark skin, and, falling over herself to apologize, tumbled into Zora's mistake. "Oh, not you, Mary. How could you think I was making fun of you?" Horn-templed, cucumber-nosed, I lay in my crib and listened, and everything that happened happened because of me. One day in January 1948, at 5 PM, my father was visited by Dr. Nullicker. There were embraces as usual and slaps on the back. "A little chess?" my father asked, ritually, because these visits were getting to be a habit. They would play chess in the old Indian way, the game of satranj, and freed by the simplicities of the chessboard from the convolutions of his life, Ahmed would daydream for an hour about the reshaping of the Quran, and then it would be 6 o'clock, cocktail hour, time for the gins. But this evening, Nullicker said, "No." And Ahmed, "No? What's this no? Come, sit, play, gossip." Nullicker interrupting, "Tonight, brothers and I, there is something I must show you." They are in a 1946 Rover now. Nullicker working the crankshaft and jumping in. They are driving north along Warden Road, past Mahalakshmi Temple on the left and Willingdon Club Golf Course on the right, leaving the racetrack behind them, cruising along Hornby Vellard beside the sea wall. Vallabhai Patel Stadium is in sight, with its giant cardboard cutouts of wrestlers, Banu Devi, the invincible woman, and Dara Singh, mightiest of all. There are chana vendors and dog walkers promenading by the sea. "Stop!" Nullicker commands, and they get out. They stand facing the sea. Sea breezes cool their faces, and out there, at the end of a narrow cement path, in the midst of the waves, is the island on which stands the tomb of Haji Ali, the mystic. Pilgrims are strolling between Vellard and tomb. "There," Nullicker points, "what do you see?" And Ahmed, mystified, "Nothing. The tomb, people. What's this about, old chap?" And Nullicker, "None of that. There." And now Ahmed sees that Nullicker's pointing finger is aimed at the cement path. "The promenade?" he asks. "What's that to you? In some minutes the tide will come and cover it up. Everybody knows." Nullicker, his skin glowing like a beacon, becomes philosophical. "Just so, brother Ahmed. Just so. Land and sea. Sea and land. The eternal struggle, not so?" Ahmed, puzzled, remains silent. "Once there were 7 islands, Nullicker reminds him. Worli, Mahim, Salsetti, Matunga, Colaba, Mazagon, Bombay. The British joined them up. Sea, brother Ahmed, became land. Land arose and did not sink beneath the tides." Ahmed is anxious for his whiskey. His lip begins to jut while pilgrims scurry off the narrowing path. "The point?" he demands. And Nullicker, dazzling with effulgence, "The point, Ahmed Bhai, is this." It comes out of his pocket. A little plaster of Paris model, 2 inches high, the tetrapod. like a three-dimensional Mercedes-Benz sign, three legs standing on his palm, a fourth rearing lingam fashion into the evening air. It transfixes my father. "What is it?" he asks, and now Nalaka tells him. "This is the baby that will make us richer than Hyderabad, bhai. The little gimmick that will make you, you and me, the masters of that." He points outwards to where sea is rushing over deserted cement pathway. "The land beneath the sea, my friend. We must manufacture these by the thousand, by tens of thousands. We must tender for reclamation contracts. Our fortune is waiting. Don't miss it, brother. This is the chance of a lifetime." Why did my father agree to dream a gynecologist's entrepreneurial dream? Why, little by little, did the vision of full-size concrete tetrapods marching over sea walls, four-legged conquerors, triumphing over the sea, capture him as surely as it had the gleaming doctor? Why, in the following years, did Ahmed dedicate himself to the fantasy of every island dweller? The myth of conquering the waves? Perhaps because he was afraid of missing yet another turning. Perhaps for the fellowship of games of Satranj. Or maybe it was Nalika's plausibility. "Your capital and my contacts, Ahmed Bhai. What problem can there be? Every great man in this city has a son brought into the world by me. No doors will close. You manufacture, I will get the contract. 50-50, fair is fair." But in my view, there is a simpler explanation. My father, deprived of wifely attention, supplanted by his son, blurred by whiskey and gin, was trying to restore his position in the world, and the dream of tetrapods offered him the chance. Wholeheartedly, he threw himself into the great folly. Letters were written, doors knocked upon, black money changed hands, all of which served to make Ahmed Sanai a name known in the corridors of Satyavalya. In the passages of the State Secretariat, they got the whiff of a Muslim who was throwing his rupees around like water. And Ahmed Sanai, drinking himself to sleep, was unaware of the danger he was in. Our lives at this period were shaped by correspondence. The Prime Minister wrote to me when I was just 7 days old. Before I could even wipe my own nose, I was receiving fan letters from Times of India readers. And one morning in January, Ahmed Sanai too received a letter he would never forget. Red eyes at breakfast were followed by the shaven chin of the working day, footsteps down the stairs, alarmed giggles of Coca-Cola girl, the squeak of a chair drawn up to a desk topped with green leather cloth, metallic noise of a metal paper cutter being lifted, colliding momentarily with telephone, the brief rasp of metal slicing envelope, and 1 minute later, Ahmed was running back up the stairs, yelling for my mother, shouting, "Amina, come here, wife! The bastards have shoved my balls in an ice bucket!" In the days after Ahmed received the formal letter informing him of the freezing of all his assets, the whole world was talking at once. "For pity's sake, Janum, such language!" Amina is saying. And is it my imagination, or does a baby blush in a sky-blue crib? And Nalika, arriving in a lather of perspiration, "I blame myself entirely. We made ourselves too public. These are bad times, Sanai Bhai. Freeze a Muslim's assets, they say, and you make him run to Pakistan, leaving all his wealth behind him. Catch the lizard's tail and he'll snap it off. This so-called secular state gets some damn clever ideas." "Everything," Ahmed Sanai is saying. "Bank account, savings, bonds, the rents from the Kurla properties, all blocked, frozen. By order," the letter says. "By order, they will not let me have four Anna's wife. Not a Chavani to see the peep show." "It's those photos in the paper," Amina decides. "Otherwise, how could those jumped-up clever dicks know whom to prosecute? My God, Janum, it's my fault." "Not 10 paise for a twist of chana," Ahmed Sanai adds. "Not one anna to give alms to a beggar, frozen like in the fridge."
"It's my fault," Ismail Ibrahim is saying. "I should have warned you, Sinai Bhai. I've heard about these freezings. Only well-off Muslims are selected naturally. You must fight."
"Tooth and nail," Homi Katrak insists. "Like a lion, like Aurangzeb, your ancestor, isn't it? Like the Rani of Jhansi. Then let's see what kind of country we've ended up in.
There are law courts in this state, Ishmael Ibrahim adds.
Nussie the duck smiles a bovine smile as she suckles Sonny. Her fingers move, absently stroking his hollows, up and around, down and about, in a steady, unchanging rhythm.
You must accept my legal services, Ishmael tells Ahmed. Absolutely free, my good friend. No, no, I won't hear of it. How can it be? We are neighbours.
Broke, Ahmed is saying, frozen like water.
Come on now, Amina interrupts him, her dedication rising to new heights. She leads him towards her bedroom.
Janum, you need to lie for some time.
And Ahmed,
what's this, wife? A time like this, cleaned out, finished, crushed like ice, and you think about...
But she has closed the door. Slippers have been kicked off. Arms are reaching towards him, and some moments later, her hands are stretching down, 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 and then...
Oh, my goodness, Janum, I thought you were just talking dirty, but it's true. So cold, Allah, so cold. Like little round cubes of ice.
Such things happen. After the state froze my father's assets, my mother began to feel them growing colder and colder. On the first day, the brass monkey was conceived, just in time, because after that, although Amina lay every night with her husband to warm him, although she snuggled up tightly when she felt him shiver as the icy fingers of rage and powerlessness spread upwards from his loins, she could no longer bear to stretch out her hand and touch, because his little cubes of ice had become too frigid to hold. We should have known something bad would happen. That January, Chowpatty Beach and Juhu and Trombe too were littered with the ominous corpses of dead pomfret, which floated, without the ghost of an explanation, belly side up like scaly fingers into shore.
Snakes and ladders.
And other omens. Comets were seen exploding above the Back Bay. It was reported that flowers had been seen bleeding real blood. And in February, the snakes escaped from the Shapsteker Institute. The rumour spread that a mad Bengali snake charmer, a Tobriwala, was travelling the country, charming reptiles from captivity, leading them out of snake farms, such as the Shapsteker, where snake venom's medicinal functions were studied and antivenins devised by the Pied Piper fascination of his flute in retribution for the partition of his beloved Golden Bengal. After a while, the rumours added that the Tobriwala was 7 feet tall, with bright blue skin. He was Krishna come to chastise his people. He was the sky-hued Jesus of the missionaries. It seems that, in the aftermath of my changeling birth, while I enlarged myself at breakneck speed, everything that could possibly go wrong began to do so. In the snake winter of early 1948, and in the succeeding hot and rainy seasons, events piled upon events, so that by the time the brass monkey was born in September, we were all exhausted and ready for a few years' rest. Escaped cobras vanished into the sewers of the city. Banded crates were seen on buses. Religious leaders described the snake escape as a warning. The god Naga had been unleashed, they intoned, as a punishment for the nation's official renunciation of its deities. We are a secular state, Nehru announced, and Maraji and Menon and Patel all agreed. But still, Ahmed Sanai shivered under the influence of the freeze. And one day, when Mary had been asking, "How are we all going to live now, madam?" Homi Katrak introduced us to Dr. Shapsteker himself. He was 81 years old. His tongue flicked constantly in and out between his papery lips, and he was prepared to pay cash rent for a top-floor apartment overlooking the Arabian Sea. Ahmed Sanai in those days had taken to his bed. The icy cold of the freeze impregnated his bedsheets. He downed vast quantities of whiskey for medicinal purposes, but it failed to warm him up. So it was Amina who agreed to let the upper story of Buckingham Villa to the old snake doctor. At the end of February, snake poison entered our lives. Dr. Shapsteker was a man who engendered wild stories. The more superstitious orderlies at his institute swore that he had the capacity of dreaming every night about being bitten by snakes, and thus remained immune to their bites. Others whispered that he was half snake himself,
the child of an unnatural union between a woman and a cobra. His obsession with the venom of the banded crate, Bungarus fasciatus, was becoming legendary. There is no known antivenin to the bite of Bungarus, but Schapsteker had devoted his life to finding one. Buying broken-down horses from the Catrack stables, among others, he injected them with small doses of poison. But the horses, unhelpfully, failed to develop antibodies, frothed at the mouth, died standing up, and had to be transformed into glue. It was said that Dr. Schapsteker had now acquired the power of killing horses simply by approaching them with a hypodermic syringe. But Amina paid no attention to these tall stories. "He is an old gentleman," she told Mary Pereira. "What should we care about people who black-tongue him? He pays his rent and permits us to live." Amina was grateful to the European snake doctor, particularly in those days of the freeze when Ahmed did not seem to have the nerve to fight. "My beloved father and mother," Amina wrote, "by my eyes and head, I swear I do not know why such things are happening to us. Ahmed is a good man, but this business has hit him hard. If you have advice for your daughter, she is greatly in need of it." 3 days after they received this letter, Adam Aziz and Reverend Mother arrived at Bombay Central Station by Frontier Mail, and Amina, driving them home in her 1946 Rover, looked out of a side window and saw the Mahalakshmi racecourse and had the first germ of her reckless idea.
"This modern decoration is all right for you young people, what's-his-name," Reverend Mother said, "but give me one old-fashioned tact to sit on. These chairs are so soft, what's-his-name. They make me feel like I'm falling."
"Is he ill?" Adam Aziz asked. "Should I examine him and prescribe medicines?"
"This is no time to hide in bed," Reverend Mother pronounced. "Now he must be a man, what's-his-name, and do a man's business."
"How well you both look, my parents," Amina cried, thinking that her father was turning into an old man who seemed to be getting shorter with the passing years, while Reverend Mother had grown so wide that armchairs, though soft, groaned beneath her weight, and sometimes, through a trick of the light, Amina thought she saw, in the centre of her father's body, a dark shadow like a hole.
"What is left in this India?" Reverend Mother asked, hand slicing air. "Go leave it all. Go to Pakistan. See how well that Zulfikar is doing. He will give you a start. Be a man, my son. Get up and start again."
"He doesn't want to speak now," Amina said. "He must rest."
"Rest!" Adam Aziz roared. "The man is a jelly." "Even Alia, what's-his-name," Reverend Mother said, "all on her own gone to Pakistan. Even she is making a decent life, teaching in a fine school. They say she will be headmistress soon."
"Shush, Mother. He wants to sleep. Let's go next door."
"There is a time to sleep, what's-his-name, and a time to wake. Listen, Mustafa is making many hundreds of rupees a month, what's-his-name, in the civil service. What is your husband? Too good to work?"
"Mother, he is upset. His temperature is so low."
"What food are you giving? From today, what's-his-name, I will run your kitchen. Young people today like babies, what's-his-name."
"Just as you like, Mother."
"I tell you, what's-his-name, it's those photos in the paper. I wrote, didn't I write? No good would come of that. Photos take away pieces of you. My God, what's-his-name, when I saw your picture, you had become so transparent I could see the writing from the other side coming right through your face."
"But that's only..."
"Don't tell me your stories, what's-his-name. I give thanks to God you have recovered from that photography."
After that day, Amina was freed from the exigencies of running her home. Reverend Mother sat at the head of the dining table, doling out food. Amina took plates to Ahmed, who stayed in bed, moaning from time to time.
"Smashed, wife. Snapped like an icicle."
While in the kitchens, Mary Pereira took the time to prepare, for the benefit of their visitors, some of the finest and most delicate mango pickles, lime chutneys and cucumber kasundis in the world. And now, restored to the status of daughter in her own home, Amina began to feel the emotions of other people's food seeping into her, because Reverend Mother doled out the curries and meatballs of intransigence, dishes imbued with the personality of their creator. Amina ate the fish salans of stubbornness and the biryanis of determination, and although Mary's pickles had a partially counteractive effect,
since she had stirred into them the guilt of her heart and the fear of discovery, so that, good as they tasted, they had the power of making those who ate them subject to nameless uncertainties and dreams of accusing fingers. The diet provided by Reverend Mother filled Amina with a kind of rage, and even produced slight signs of improvement in her defeated husband. So that finally the day came when Amina, who had been watching me play incompetently with toy horses of sandalwood in the bath, inhaling the sweet odours of sandalwood which the bathwater released, suddenly rediscovered within herself the adventurous streak which was her inheritance from her fading father, the streak which had brought Adam Aziz down from his mountain valley. Amina turned to Mary Pereira and said, "I'm fed up. If nobody in this house is going to put things right, then it's just going to be up to me." Toy horses galloped behind Amina's eyes as she left Mary to dry me and marched into her bedroom. Remembered glimpses of Mahalakshmi racecourse cantered in her head as she pushed aside saris and petticoats. The fever of a reckless scheme flushed her cheeks as she opened the lid of an old tin trunk. Filling her purse with the coins and rupee notes of grateful patients and wedding guests, my mother went to the races. With the brass monkey growing inside her, my mother stalked the paddocks of the racecourse, named after the goddess of wealth. Braving early morning sickness and varicose veins, she stood in line at the tote window, putting money on 3 horse accumulators and long odds outsiders. Ignorant of the first thing about horses, she backed mares known not to be stayers to win long races. She put her money on jockeys because she liked their smiles. Clutching a purse full of the dowry which had lain untouched in its trunk since her own mother had packed it away, she took wild flutters on stallions who looked fit for the Schapstecker Institute, and won, and won, and won.
"Good news," Ishmael Ibrahim is saying. "I always thought you should fight the bastards. I'll begin proceedings at once." "But it will take cash, Amina. Have you got cash?"
"The money will be there."
"Not for myself," Ishmael explains. "My services are, as I said, free, gratis, absolutely. But, forgive me, you must know how things are. One must give little presents to people to smooth one's way."
"Here," Amina hands him an envelope. "Will this do for now?"
"My God!"
Ishmael Ibrahim drops the packet in surprise, and rupee notes in large denominations scatter all over his sitting room floor. "Where did you lay your hands on?" And Amina, "Better you don't ask, and I won't ask how you spend it." Schapstecker money paid for our food bills, but horses fought our war. The streak of luck of my mother at the racetrack was so long, a seam so rich, that if it hadn't happened, it wouldn't have been credible. For month after month, she put her money on a jockey's nice, tidy hairstyle, or a horse's pretty piebald colouring, and she never left the track without a large envelope stuffed with notes.
"Things are going well," Ishmael Ibrahim told her, "but, Amina sister, God knows what you are up to. Is it decent? Is it legal?"
And Amina, "Don't worry your head. What can't be cured must be endured. I'm doing what must be done." Never once in all that time did my mother take pleasure in her mighty victories, because she was weighed down by more than a baby. Eating Reverend Mother's curries filled with ancient prejudices, she had become convinced that gambling was the next worst thing on earth, next to alcohol. So, although she was not a criminal, she felt consumed by sin. Verrucas plagued her feet, although Purushottam the sadhu, who sat under our garden tap until dripping water created a bald patch amid the luxuriantly matted hair on his head, was a marvel at charming them away. But throughout the snake winter and the hot season, my mother fought her husband's fight. You ask, how is it possible? How could a housewife, however assiduous, however determined, win fortunes on the horses day after racing day, month after month? You think to yourself, aha, that homie Catrack, he's a horse owner, and everyone knows that most of the races are fixed. Amina was asking her neighbour for hot tips. A plausible notion, but Mr. Catrack himself lost as often as he won. He saw my mother at the racetrack and was astounded by her success.
"Please," Amina asked him, "Catrack Saab, let this be our secret. Gambling is a terrible thing.
It would be so shaming if my mother found out. And Catrac, nodding dazedly, said,
Just as you wish.
So it was not the Parsee who was behind it, but perhaps I can offer another explanation. Here it is. In a sky-blue crib, in a sky-blue room with a fisherman's pointing finger on the wall. Here. Whenever his mother goes away, clutching a purse full of secrets, is baby Salim, who has acquired an expression of the most intense concentration, whose eyes have been seized by a singleness of purpose of such enormous power that it has darkened them to deep navy blue, and whose nose is twitching strangely while he appears to be watching some distant event, to be guiding it from a distance, just as the moon controls the tides.
Coming to court very soon, Ismail Ibrahim said, I think you can be fairly confident. My God, Amina, have you found King Solomon's mines?
The moment I was old enough to play board games, I fell in love with snakes and ladders. Oh, perfect balance of rewards and penalties. Oh, seemingly random choices made by tumbling dice. Clambering up ladders, slithering down snakes. I spent some of the happiest days of my life, when in my time of trial, my father challenged me to master the game of shatranj. I infuriated him by preferring to invite him instead to chance his fortune among the ladders and nibbling snakes. All games have morals, and the game of snakes and ladders captures, as no other activity can hope to do, the eternal truth that for every ladder you climb, a snake is waiting just around the corner. And for every snake, a ladder will compensate. But it's more than that, no mere carrot and stick affair, because implicit in the game is the unchanging two-ness of things, the duality of up against down. Good against evil, the solid rationality of ladders balances the occult sinuosities of the serpent. In the opposition of staircase and cobra, we can see, metaphorically or conceivable, oppositions. Alpha against omega. Father against mother. Here is the war of Mary and Musa, and the polarities of knees and nose. But I found, very early in my life, that the game lacked one crucial dimension, that of ambiguity. Because, as events are about to show, it is also possible to slither down a ladder and climb to triumph on the venom of a snake. Keeping things simple for the moment, however, I recall that no sooner had my mother discovered the ladder to victory represented by her racecourse luck than she was reminded that the gutters of the country were still teeming with snakes. Amina's brother Hanif had not gone to Pakistan. Following the childhood dream, which he had whispered to Rashid the rickshaw boy in an Agra cornfield, he had arrived in Bombay and sought employment in the great film studios. Precociously confident, he had not only succeeded in becoming the youngest man ever to be given a film to direct in the history of the Indian cinema, he had also wooed and married one of the brightest stars of that celluloid heaven, the divine Pia, whose face was her fortune, and whose saris were made of fabrics whose designers had clearly set out to prove that it was possible to incorporate every colour known to man in a single pattern. Reverend Mother did not approve of the divine peer, but Hanif, of all my family, was the one who was free of her confining influence, a jolly, burly man with the booming laugh of the boatman Tai and the explosive, innocent anger of his father Adam Aziz. He took her to live simply in a small, unfilmy apartment on Marine Drive, telling her, "Plenty of time to live like emperors after I've made my name." She acquiesced. She starred in his first feature, which was partly financed by Homi Catrac and partly by D.W. Rama Studios, PVT Limited. It was called The Lovers of Kashmir. And one evening, in the midst of her racing days, Amina Sanai went to the premiere. Her parents did not come, thanks to Reverend Mother's loathing of the cinema, against which Adam Aziz no longer had the strength to struggle, just as he, who had fought with Mian Abdullah against Pakistan, no longer argued with her when she praised the country, retaining just enough strength to dig in his heels and refuse to emigrate. But Amit Sanai, revived by his mother-in-law's cookery, but resentful of her continued presence, got to his feet and accompanied his wife. They took their seats next to Hanif and Pia, and the male star of the film, one of India's most successful lover boys, I.S. Nayyar. And although they didn't know it, a serpent waited in the wings. But in the meanwhile, let us permit Hanif Aziz to have his moment, because The Lovers of Kashmir contained a notion which was to provide my uncle with a spectacular, though brief, period of triumph. In those days, it was not permitted for lover boys and their leading ladies to touch one another on screen, for fear that their osculations might corrupt the nation's youth. But 33 minutes after the beginning of The Lovers, the premiere audience began to give off a low buzz of shock, because Pia and Nayyar had begun to kiss. Not one another, but things. Pia kissed an apple, sensuously, with all the rich fullness of her painted lips, then passed it to Nayyar, who planted upon its opposite face a virilely passionate mouth. This was the birth of what came to be known as the indirect kiss. And how much more sophisticated a notion it was than anything in our current cinema, how pregnant with longing and eroticism. The cinema audience, which would nowadays cheer raucously at the sight of a young couple diving behind a bush, which would then begin to shake ridiculously, so low have we sunk in our ability to suggest, watched riveted to the screen as the love of Pia and Nayyar against a background of Dal Lake and ice-blue Kashmiri sky expressed itself in kisses applied to cups of pink Kashmiri tea. By the fountains of Shalimar they pressed their lips to a sword. But now, at the height of Hanif Aziz's triumph, the serpent refused to wait. Under its influence, the house lights came up. Against the larger-than-life figures of Pia and Nayyar kissing mangoes as they mouthed to playback music, the figure of a timorous, inadequately bearded man was seen marching onto the stage beneath the screen, microphone in hand. The serpent can take most unexpected forms. Now, in the guise of this ineffectual house manager, it unleashed its venom. Pia and Nayyar faded and died, and the amplified voice of the bearded man said, "Ladies and gents, your pardon, but there's terrible news." His voice broke, a sob from the serpent to lend power to its teeth, and then continued, "This afternoon at Birla House in Delhi, our beloved Mahatma was killed. Some madman shot him in the stomach, ladies and gentlemen. Our Bapu is gone." The audience had begun to scream before he finished. The poison of his words entered their veins. There were grown men rolling in the aisles, clutching their bellies, not laughing, but crying, "Hai Ram! Hai Ram!" and women tearing their hair, the city's finest coiffures tumbling around the ears of the poisoned ladies. There were film stars yelling like fishwives and something terrible to smell in the air. And Hanif whispered, "Get out of here, big sister. If a Muslim did this thing, there will be hell to pay." For every ladder, there is a snake. And for 48 hours after the abortive end of The Lovers of Kashmir, our family remained within the walls of Buckingham Villa. "Put furniture against the doors, what's-his-name," Reverend Mother ordered. "If there are Hindu servants, let them go home." And Amina did not dare to visit the racetrack. But for every snake, there is a ladder. And finally the radio gave us a name. Nathurum Godse. "Thank God," Amina burst out, "it's not a Muslim name." And Adam, upon whom the news of Gandhi's death had placed a new burden of age, "This Godse is nothing to be grateful for." Amina, however, was full of the light-headedness of relief. She was rushing dizzily up the long ladder of relief. Why not, after all? By being Godse, he has saved our lives. Amit Sanai, after rising from his supposed sickbed, continued to behave like an invalid. In a voice like cloudy glass, he told Amina, "So, you have told Ishmael to go to court. Very well, good, but we will lose. In these courts you have to buy judges." And Amina, rushing to Ishmael, "Never, never under any circumstances must you tell Ahmed about the money. A man must keep his pride." And later on,
No, Janum, I'm not going anywhere. No, the baby is not being tiring at all. You rest. I must go to shop. Maybe I will visit Hanif. We women, you know, must fill up our days.
And coming home with envelopes brimming with rupee notes. Take Ishmael. Now that he's up, we have to be quick and careful. And sitting dutifully beside her mother in the evenings.
Yes, of course you're right. And Ahmed will be getting so rich soon. You'll just see.
And endless delays in court, and envelopes emptying, and the growing baby, nearing the point at which Amina will not be able to insert herself behind the driving wheel of the 1946 Rover. And can her luck hold? And Musa and Mary quarrelling like aged tigers? What starts fights? What remnants of guilt, fear, shame, pickled by time in Mary's intestines, led her willingly, unwillingly, to provoke the aged bearer in a dozen different ways? By a tilt of the nose to indicate her superior status, by aggressive counting of rosary beads under the nose of the devout Muslim, by acceptance of the title Mausi, little mother, bestowed upon her by the other estate servants, which Musa saw as a threat to his status, by excessive familiarity with the Begum Sahiba. Little giggled whispers in corners, just loud enough for formal, stiff, correct Musa to hear and feel somehow cheated. What tiny grain of grit in the sea of old age now washing over the old bearer, lodged between his lips, to fatten into the dark pearl of hatred? Into what unaccustomed torpors did Musa fall, becoming leaden of hand and foot, so that vases were broken, ashtrays spilled, and a veiled hint of forthcoming dismissal from Mary's conscious or unconscious lips grew into an obsessive fear which rebounded upon the person who started it off? And, not to omit social factors, what was the brutalizing effect of servant status of a servant's room behind a black-stoved kitchen in which Musa was obliged to sleep along with gardener, odd job boy, and Hamel, while Mary slept in style on a rush mat beside a newborn child? And was Mary blameless or not? Did her inability to go to church, because in churches you found confessionals, and in confessionals secrets could not be kept, turn sour inside her and make her a little sharp, a little hurtful? Or must we look beyond psychology, seeking our answer in statements such as, there was a snake lying in wait for Mary, and Musa was doomed to learn about the ambiguity of ladders? Or further still, beyond snake and ladder, should we see the hand of fate in the quarrel and say, in order for Musa to return as explosive ghost, in order for him to adopt the role of bomb in Bombay, it was necessary to engineer a departure? Or, descending from such sublimities to the ridiculous, could it be that Ahmed Sinai, whom whiskey provoked, whom gins goaded into excesses of rudeness, had so incensed the aged bearer that his crime, with which he equaled Mary's record, was committed out of the injured pride of an abused old servitor, and was nothing to do with Mary at all? Ending questions, I confine myself to facts. Musa and Mary were perpetually at daggers drawn. And yes, Ahmed insulted him, and Amina's pacifying efforts may not have been successful. And yes, the fuddling shadows of age had convinced him he would be dismissed without warning at any moment. And so it was that Amina came to discover one August morning that the house had been burgled. The police came. Amina reported what was missing. A silver spittoon encrusted with lapis lazuli, gold coins, bejeweled samovars, and silver tea services, the contents of a green tin tray.